well, this is Peter Riley, and I'm not going to say everyone's name and go to Peter, but I've heard Peter read my sock before, and I've read quite a lot of his stuff, and I think it's been very, very interesting and also enjoyable evening. Peter.
What I thought I'd do, since poetry readings are rather problematic things, I mean, they're very difficult to listen to for a long time. I think an hour is a very long time to listen to somebody spouting his poetry. I was going to try and make it a bit varied, and I had various schemes of different methods of doing this, one of which was to read a prose piece in the middle, but I don't think I can do that. I think it's too long. It's 10 solid pages of prose, which by my reckoning would take about 40 minutes, and can't do it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the normal thing that you do on these occasions. You read your latest stuff, right? But I'm going to do a bit of that, and then do something different. I'm going to read some very, very old stuff, and then resume some of the recent stuff at the end. And the old stuff is very different, so that should split it up a bit anyway. The old stuff is also much easier on the ears, I think, actually, on the whole. So that'll be a sort of relaxed middle section, in a way. There's this new book due out by the end of the year called Tracks and Mineshafts, and the other month in Leamington Spa I read the end of it, so I thought I'd read the beginning of it this week. I mean, it's a good thing to do at the beginning of a poetry reading, to read the beginning of a book after all. This book has a very rather a beginning. It takes a long time to get started. It begins with a poem which I must have read last time, I don't remember. A poem called Material Soul, which is actually separated off from the rest of the book. That's to say, I've arranged blank pages after it, but it looks very much like I wanted it before the title page, actually, but the publisher didn't like that, so it's not. But that was the kind of feeling I had in mind, that before the book itself even starts, there's this poem, which is just a total statement of belief, nothing to do with poetry or anything, just a statement of belief called Material Soul. I'll read that first. Given to death and life, no choice, fallen into these terms, born as the tide bears the wave to its strike, cut to bedrock, crest, charge the shore. Given to this, life carving itself out of its knowledge, and the earth is like a cup to which the lip fits, and the senses' final construct moves relentlessly through substance to the houses of light, mutual devotion joined to death. Danger specifies its fear, the message forms its own access or nerve, and just behind the point of contact, perception opens onto a cleared space, a settlement holding people of all ages together. The whole of life is this shift back, this rearing and arrival, which leaves a mark, a birth documentation or yell echoing down the unlivable corridors and arcades of transitional time. Flesh scores lines in the calcium slag of earth, and the spirit wakes. The needle enters the groove, polar tension shakes the circuit, which responds, gapes, tremors, issues forth into the acts of day for good. Peace is nothing without this resistance, engaging distance beyond any possible repair to the end, the inhabited city. And this is what we see and live. All round us the world arrives at its end. Well, I wish it and plunge into the stone. You never see me again. The interesting thing about that for me was that, having decided to hell with poetry, I'm going to write a statement of belief to preface the book. The more honest I was about it, and the more focused I was on it, the more poetic it became, the more it became very much like another of my poems. Then there's a section called Eight Preludes, which I'll read and then stop this book and read some of the earlier stuff. The eight preludes are to do with eight different attitudes or feelings about getting going on what you know is going to be a big work. It already was a big work by the time Eight Preludes were written, actually, which is kind of cheating, but still. They are exactly what they claim to be, preludes to a book of poems. And the first one is to do with the attitude of kind of why bother, really? What's it all for anyway? And in order to do that, adopts a rather Beckettian tone, which is rather foreign to me. Each day some further light, each day some farther dark. Carry on, go here, there, make a note of it. What for? Climb the hill, walk down, get in the car and drive away. It is nothing to do with me. Valley, stream, meadow, waterfall, gorge. There is something else there. Nothing to do with us, making no difference. We can go, we can stay at home and drink tea. It is still there. Far reaches of the upper manifold. Where is it? What is it? Green chapel. If it rains, it rains. Smear of cloud in the distance. Book of nothing, not inhabited. Ruins of the whole thing. Light on water, quick in blue shale cliffs. Thick in fern, light filling. Bearing the vocabulary of a curved lack. Mineral vein running down the hillside, up the other side, and away over the moors, worked or not worked, unknown, what difference does that make? Light filling the valley, with not a soul to be seen. Dark beams of disappointment filling the city streets, death shadowing the grass. What am I then as you which otherwise stay sleeping, or, if we weren't in the dark star's way, would our sense still open beyond the ground, whether we knew it or not? No, the material soul yearns by the day's annoyance for real. So does love in silver boxes, hence dispatch our joyful stake, and I turn us again, front to front to front. Second prelude is to do with a sense of the whole thing happening, whether you want it to or not. It's an image of somebody lying in bed in a dark room, and the entire sort of theatre of imagination is outside the house. Night outside is the theatre of our patience, as you lie beside me in the dark loft. Distant thrust of steam locomotive in some vast marshalling yard, cold papers blown across the square. Night contracts the distances of love and fortune to a presence, angles filling the dark room, loud with inaudible instructions, like an equestrian statue in the full moon, and a faraway telephone rings. It is me trying to contact a third person, out of the past, or lost in the city streets, while night's cover persists. Footsteps of the heart agent passing by ticket office and clock tower to an abandoned station. Then false dawn brings a nil invoice and faint lines near the ceiling. A small child runs down the corridor holding a toy angel, wings flapping, screaming at us not to owe. The world is wanted and full, our full hearts crack at it. And famine of the earth in pictorial wars, fake tensions, monetarization of time, whereas the emptiness is real, and there is no return, no restitution. Oh, keep intact, the underwing starts, the cup through it. It's also an assemblage of images taken from the paintings of Georges de Chiricot, as you might have caught on, possibly. What's the third one about? I'm not sure, actually. Yes, it's the third one is a sort of almost comic prose piece in two bits, which is to do with thinking you are doing one thing and in fact you're doing something else totally different. Perhaps. You don't know. You might be. It's also to do with thinking you're doing something important in your life and realising that you're spending most of your time sort of washing dishes and things like that, really. And that's fine. First part of prelude three. A sense of urgency, and the kitchen floods. Most of the time gets mislaid. The weekdays pass to the side of us. Call to the present, we wind ourselves up, but something quite remote comes out. Old jazz, demolished cafes where we breakfasted in our prime, a head full of grey mornings, quick postcards, old thorns. What time do I have to get up tomorrow? Most of the time belongs to most of the people. But I can't hear you. I can't find you. Hero of our time, toy of our governors. I can't read you. I can't hear you for the score of milk teeth, bone against bone, teeth chewing teeth, in the cavernous half-light of a bottling shop. Hero of the double white line, humanity brought to the idea of its own preservation, dying of imputative success, chewing itself to image pulp, but anyway, when will a human idea ever eat real raisins or hold my hand on the way to the station when the time comes for questions? Every time it rains, I know a nation is the logarithm of love. How the present tangles itself in desire. How the mess we make of it unwinds into space. And the three little pendants to prelude 3. That was actually prelude 3A. It's followed by prelude 3, prelude 3B and prelude 3X. Three little ones. Prelude 3 goes, snap. There is a reason why discomfort gains the root. The honey drips, but the fire leaps. Be held out. Prelude 3B. The reasons are all eaten in secret or baked into Easter buns. Superfluous honey corrodes the map. We spit out pips and fragments of grindstone into the fire. 3X. Thin liquids. Give us some annals of the orchard, some fire-laden rob. You know the word rob? I've gone out of use a bit. It's a kind of prehistoric jam. They don't make it anymore. It's a very liquid jam made with honey. Got a bite to it, I believe. I won't read prelude 4. Prelude 5. It's very obvious what prelude 5 is about. I might stumble occasionally reading some of these things because the fair copy is with a man who's typing it on a machine. And I've got a copy with all the corrections and things in the margin and that, which makes it a bit difficult occasionally. Especially with this one. But I might read what it was before I corrected it because that's a lot easier. Prelude 5 is just in prose. I am constantly bugged by something I think I'm supposed to be saying. The philosophy of poetry, or the joys of wisdom, or the truth that snaps the world back into place. Where is it? It's easy enough to focus on nothing like a missing pilot and set absence into the text just to have it there before us, newly reflected, but you are elsewhere. And it's very uncertain that something human is actually there at the end of this dispersed line, wanting or waiting for anything on earth. But surely the fire is getting low. If we don't signal our love, there will be no reason for dying. I turn to the simple, sky-trapped animal, the look in thy heart and right bit. Plentiful and expensive. The heart, of course, is a non-existent book in which we read the education of the world, the adventures of Bugs Hunter. What rubbish. I am not I. Pity the tale of me. Meanwhile, someone is stockpiling sugar in an abandoned theatre across the road, and the cat returns for her due. Granted, naturally, we can't turn back at this stage. Open her tin, welcome her children behind the couch, find them as good homes as time and this world afford. These necessary acts compose, one by one, the map of grace. Everything glows with absolute presence. Couch, kittens, bugs, boredom, dark, nest. All this slowly gathers into a landscape to which we surface. An inhabited and structured landscape with walls and ditches and paving by which we hold on to the world like a vast hand. And that also is love, whose grip, rooted into purpose, steadies us against the earth exactly here, dispersing in our heat, but consolidated by fear, that is the tension of the wing. What wing? What rubbish again? Opposite the theatre of sugar, a wing of rubbish opens to our esteem. There's a tradition in my poetry reading at universities that 20 minutes from the start, a porter puts his head through the door and says something like, "Oh! I didn't know you'd booked this room." It's happened so often, it's unbelievable. We've not been locked in.
But it was a porter.
It was a porter, yes. I knew immediately. Here comes the porter. Page 6. Willing also to be remembered. That's an interesting line, because it started off as willing also to be forgotten, and decided that willing also to be remembered was a much more demanding challenge. Willing also to be remembered. Lost in fairest love task scholarships, such as fetch sight to its own predilection, where the broken edges catch the light at a sharpness, a tract, where sense and love fuse in the energy of script, holding the world together at that point. This prelude is the idealistic number. And there is immense wastage, entirely ours, as we humanize the world and then resent it, objectify it and wonder where it's gone, and place such limits in our speaking that most of the people become figments of something past, like an aggregate plum too late for winter, complete immersion in crust. But I also think of you as fairest before sight in a vocabulary which is generally considered nonsense out of the 13th century context, and still fairer dark by the light that glims beyond. Well, it is night at the crossroads, and many years since a dignitary came this way. The faces of the houses are silent. Time suddenly rusts. Short prelude 7, which is to do with vocation, the sense of being called upon. Faint call from the mines, intrusive holes in the landscape, or star targets. From the core of the earth, where the one person is undivided and the market serves the home. From the oceanic cycles, where the dream disperses into day and we cannot rest in our value. From the self-cast. And the last prelude, which is much longer than the others, two-page prelude, starts off like the others, how it is talking about itself, what you're going to do, or what are you doing, for two stanzas, and then breaks into a narrative with a little conclusion at the end. If you want messages, you must provide an orifice. But to really want messages is itself an orifice, a lesion, an unasked interruption of the diurnal pact. Life ferments in this cleft, packed with honour and disdain, drawing us ever larger and further on to this self-same world that listens. The rest is vain stuff. Surely it is this whole particular, this action we are, that draws our arms into the funnel, opening and closing as the light wing flutters back and forth, wisdom and rubbish. Poetry remains the flight. And now, if I can just get out of this notional claw, I'll find out exactly where I am. I'm in the dining shed again, exactly. Up and about my morning task, I crawl out this morning through the floss of dream. In a wink, I fill the kettle and forget it. I shake the radio. I wince. The light outside is clearer than any hypothesis. The edge resounds in light because we don't linger. And off to work I go. I enter a solid block of morning light scored with branch lines. I close the door before you even wake, check ignition and brakes, and turn again to the book, to the page shown, the passage marked before. Fate, it says, is a professional improviser. I hunch under the brow as the overtakers glide past in their dream wagons, Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, fleeces thick in oil. Feeling rushed, like crowded, mount to a signal. I turn into a lay-by with herbage. Rain clouds the stream, the entire landscape is verbal. I lean on the parapet while the police matrons check my documentation and listen to the story of the water vole, his home under the bridge, the pain of his extended incisors. He breathes under Saturn and scurries along the bank. He eats or is taken. He knows that. His duties end at his honour to himself. We have considerable doubts, but raise a song of this inadequacy. The thrush couldn't fault. And we keep it, chuck it over the shoulder for luck and resume direction. Amended stone. Nothing any longer bears on us that isn't ours. Nothing any longer wears us that isn't love. Hell, in some centuries' language, is where no one makes his life anymore. We have the key to it, fast to the wrist under the sleeve, the misplaced heart. So we mine into light in a way no office can endure or regulate except the office of delight. Past and future safe inside a timed shell. Or we have no power at all and are in anyone's hell at the flick of a card, no longer us. We return, the cloud retires, the demonstration thins out, but love is farther still. And then the book launches into an immense long poem. How many times? I'll read a bit more of that book later. It's not very much of it. We'll see how the time goes. Read the end of it. Yes, I thought I'd have a break from that now and reveal to the world for the first time some bits of a book called London 1963 to 1965 by Peter Riley, which has never been published and never will be published. There's a few very early poems which were rewritten in about 1978. So they aren't exactly the early poems which they look like. The 1978 version, which I think I ought to have been writing between 1963 and 1965, but wasn't altogether, actually. What I was actually writing at that time was some sort of weird thing halfway between William Carlos Williams and John Milton or something. It's been tidied up a bit, mainly by chopping bits off, getting rid of resolutions and things. The book has a kind of narrative which won't emerge much, I'm going to just pick bits out, but it's a book of being alone in London, or almost alone in London. and you're straight out of a college or university. I'm wondering what on earth could possibly do. Arrival in the city. I met a man who wasn't Oedipus' brother. He was his sister and his mother. That's the only surviving round couplet from this. I lie awake at night listening to the city meandering through autumn. Cool, smoky evenings. Anyone's passed like an awful procession. Stuffed figures ready for burning. My shoes make a little thunder in the leaves. Red and brown dust on my ankles like a second-hand bookshop. The days dwindle down to a precious brew set in a chalice we reach for as the year turns. Its age is not human. How is it to continue with its own changes, this capital, centre we take with us, everywhere we go, like a ring, so that where we are will always be, in some sense, London? Whatever way we have to earn a living, there'll at least, and for a start, be consolation, a way and fact of home. The cathedral in this city gathers beauty in the morning as a mountain does, by distance. The bird flies to its nest far above. Yes, we'll get out of this one day, these squalid bed-sitting rooms and selling lampshades or whatever we do, which certainly isn't what we came here to do. But it's 1964 and still very quiet. We behave roughly like secretaries and can only think of an English pastoral alternative, slopes and curlews. And one day we will get there, one day we'll take in the capital. Here it is also our own loving we live. I see Christmas as a great ache coming my way over the next 3 months. I haven't spoken to anyone for 2 weeks. I said, Charing Cross single, to a real human soul behind a grill. The rest of the time I breathed. You weren't in the streets. Somewhere you moved or sat still, indoors or out, I saw the street and it was empty of you into the distance. All the possibilities were nothing. The absence separated, leaving no room anywhere. The missing questions wanted you back. The lost uncertainties begged to be reinstated. It occurred to me while I was reading that, that this, since poetry reading is a form of publication, this is the one definitive and only publication of this book. And it's on tape. Today I visited the room where we first lay together, at the back of the mission. The mission is a place that some of our posher universities set up in the 19th century in the slums of London, intending to convert the wogs to something. But most of them are in a state of decay now, and they're used as dossing houses by the down and out undergraduates who couldn't think what to do with their time. And I lived in one of these places. It's an incredible place. Today I visited the room where we first lay together at the back of the mission, with that tiny arched window onto a brick wall. Someone's been decorating. The walls are different and the bed's gone. That window was too small and we had to keep the light on all day. I didn't switch the light on. Without curtains and all that whitewash, it's a lot lighter now. You did your best, as I remember, with one coloured light bulb and two joss sticks to give a certain feeling of occasion or even mystery. Christ, that shoddiness was the spirit of delight. and now someone's left a bucket full of whitewash with a stick in it in the middle of the floor, and actually the whole area seems to be subject to a febrile cleansing mania. They're pulling all the houses down, all the streets lined with corrugated iron. That old tramp still wanders around as if nothing had changed. It's cleaning your room, free of dust, free of flowers in an old jar. That bit of early 60s London Underground Expressionism we found daubed all over the south wall has been washed over. And I hear the mission's whole function is under review now, and due for rationalisation, it is felt its function to serve the community in which it stands is best maintained by a certain orderliness, and etc. Actually, the community has been knocked down, and I don't know if that small space at the back is going to be anything but waste. Let's only hope there, or miles away, it can serve someone else's fate. We need sites for the theatre of affection, quite dingy holes or corners, and the wonderful thing is we find them, even in the most unlikely places. I mean a disused vestry. It's your kindness, I mean, kept in my head, in a small upper room with one inadequate window, while they fall around it. It is owned by the church and shall stand forever. Some of them are just simply images. Soil exposed where flowers were. Empty house, its cold stone face, tinsel penny moon on the sky. Things like that. This poem has a title. This is called Break. B-R-E-A-K. In Selfridge's staff canteen, the picture on the wall represents a view of a bay with hills rising behind it and one white cottage on the shore. The whole landscape is blue, green and blue-green. It's a thick encrustation done, I think, with stencils and commercial gloss paint. It's very big. Sitting here, I stare at it until I see through it to some actual place, a bay, the wind-lifted cloud skirmishes, the dry sea noise. Of course, I think myself into it, inhabiting that house, in it, stirring my tea, hot air rushing up the chimney, and the steps down to the sand. Naturally, I think of this as a form of rest. I'm not alone. I mean, I think a lot of people here do that. Perhaps that's why it was put there, or at least, ugly as it is, it would seem to represent an admission on someone's part that the version of life subsisting inside this building is unspeakable. The gloss is heavy and is now reinforced with a lot of grease because it's close to the serving counter, and over that, condensation. I think it is someplace colonized. The final repulsiveness of the wall painting confirms our shabbiness and repels us back to our stalls, another sector of our time eaten. We are told exactly what to do. A few more of these. The human body is the thought of the universe. I don't know if that's by me or not. I found it in a notebook of this time, among all the poems. There's one line there, now it's two, and it's either by me or it's something I found somewhere. I had the faintest idea, so I thought I'd better put it down just in case I wrote it. I hope I did, but I couldn't be sure about that. Primrose Hill, where Blake saw, what was it Blake saw on Primrose Hill? St. Paul? No, that was the Strand. Anyway, Blake saw something. I think it was the spiritual sun. And there are trees and leaves, houses, lamp posts, west face of the zoological gardens, a few cars and buses passing, and a skyline indicating London. And the sun, a pink circle in the sky, because of the mist, millions of tiny droplets, and in each one a light. That'd be almost enough of these, actually. Any more reasonably pleasant things? Now most of these, I don't want for various reasons, perhaps to read it with their length, their acceptability, one from another. I did want to read this one. Yes, there's a section I don't like, sort of neo-surrealist section, and then it starts again. An old woman without gloves pushes an old pram over the asphalt. Erratically, worried, spits on the asphalt, coughs, and spits again. I really like that one. That's probably my favourite poem. Next one is called Against Betjeman. You know, Betjeman. Poet laureate, isn't he? Against Betjeman. A back garden in Slough. A girl sits under a tree, suckling a small child. And this is in Slough. This is what is happening in Slough. Outside this circle, there is no safety. That one ought to be lift that one out of this book somewhere. Poems about Dr. Leavis. By night the tap drips. The gas fire hisses for more shillings. Isolated cars pass by outside. No animals allowed in this house by order. Be ready to leave any time at short notice. Always keep a suitcase handy. Snow came, but was trodden away quickly into slush and mud. Cold black lines intersect on the pavement. And the whole book suddenly ends by translating Chinese poems, which is a strange thing to do. It's a sort of sudden removal, total removal from London. A sudden declaration in a way that London is a total impossibility. This is my London book. And indeed, this time I moved away from it and translated Chinese poems, quite a lot of them. And I thought I'd just read one of these sort of little groups or sequences of these Chinese translations. They're not real translations, of course, but they just about work. Oh, here we are. They're nearly all from the same Chinese poet who was called Li Ho. And of course there are conflations and collations and improvisations on existing English versions. And I move away from that kind of poetry in a way. One of the things that interested me about this one is that they consist of almost nothing except detail. That was mainly, I think, why I undertook this work. You could have a poem consisting of almost nothing but observed detail. I don't think it does work in total, but it was an interesting episode. This has about 20 little sections. Today in the fifth month, rice shoots, smooth flooded fields, green, slender, far mountains, their summits pressurize the valley, and worry me, the jagged green rocks, that they fall. Two. Pure bright air, autumn, miles away, cool winds in the green, authorized land. Three. A certain loneliness among the aromatic bamboos, white powdered tree walls, fresh green leaves, furry grass, moats, sad, shining dew, minor tears on the ground. A road winds up to a green cavern among thick leaves. Flowers on the road, faded, drunk, red. The old willows thick with wood lice, and deep in the top leaves the screech of the cicadas. The poet's presence and his statements was a crafty old poet, this Chinese bloke. This is why I got fascinated by him. He goes on and on about these things and his actual presence, what he intends to say. So it creeps in, you hardly notice it. Great scarves, this is fourth, yes, great scarves of yellow vine come woven down, and purple flag leaves netting on the thin streams. Coins of thick moss on the stones, and leaves hanging in clusters like fruit. 5. Yes, the newly washed sand, white and smooth. Horses' hooves have made green ideograms. In the evening the fish meander freely, the stork stands there in the dusk, thin and alone, damp frogs croaking, a slow stream suddenly upset and thrown against the rocks. Six. The true jade road, crooked and sinuous, virgin goddess lying on purple flower. 7. Coils of willow sedge on the pebbles and streams, mountain berries hanging down, scarlet crimson, young cypress trees waving like fans, red juice oozing from fat vines. This constant nudging at images of fruitfulness and solitude. Next, the sound of a stream, hollow songs, glowing ears of corn bent down the autumn slopes, golden orioles parody a girl trying to sing like a bird, waterfall like a white satin dress, and the spray full of bright eyes, honeycombed cliffs ready to fall, clumps of bamboo shoots on the highest rocks, and a thin-necked bird shouts on the stonework of the fountain. Next. Certainly isn't a straight translation. Sunbeams shunt off the brown mist, and new clouds come up, coloured, transparent depths, silent and clear. This awful summer night, west wind streaming, the clear air. Next. She sleeps in her shrine, quiet jade face, burnt cinnamon incense this dark night at her fortunate throne. Veils of scent clothe her. She speculates, dreams on her sleeping altar, waiting for the king. Ancient bronze birds roosting, the old palace walls broken and yellow like pepper. Next. What remains of the bells chime? The wandering courtier hears them, full of icy thoughts. Next. Red door springs wrapped in cold ivy. Alien spirits inhabit the dragon curtains. Flowering willows stick through the green blinds, the scented bedsheets of the fallen dukes. The singing girls are dust on the worm-eaten floor, the dancers' skirts curled up like thin clouds. Custom was once observed with such love in the villages. No one would beat time with pestles at a funeral, no witchcraft about plagues and diseases. Old men with fish scale skins, generous and kind, children with horn-plated hair, bright and modest. No judges needed at court. Nothing against the tax collectors. That's one in which he comes out in the open. Bamboo leaves now, and clusters of bamboo. Stone banks attract fishermen, anglers, the streams are liquid scarfs. Banana trees lower their papery leaves. High summits gleam, dazzle like shot silk. Alone I look at the moon. It brushes out my sorrow. Spring, the stream goes like a cup of... The what? Oh, yes. Spring, the stream goes like a cup of Teo Chien's wine, the old drunkard. Distant bells chiming. A lone bird twitters in response. Soaring porphyry rocks, gleaming black and purple. The dangerous explosions of spring against the tumult of the fountains. Next. The moon floats on a smooth cobalt sky and is dim. A stranger, the enemy, in the rugged clouds. A cool light overflows the banks of the streams. The mountain shapes blur. This man used to wander around all day on the back of a pony, writing poems on bits of paper. As soon as he finished one, he'd hang it into a bag, which was strung around the back. It works. Just by doing this, other people were given the task of copying them out or collecting them, whatever you do with them. The last one is a bit longer. Again, consists almost entirely of detail, which gets very difficult to put into English, actually. When he reaches this three or four lines, it's all right. When you get a cluster of 12 lines of detail like that, it begins to seem very strange as an English poem. Plane trees moan in the wind like a jade-cased harp. Fireflies, mists from the embroidered city. Willow branches spin out long streamers. A quivering bamboo grove rustles. Sound of small flutes. Green moss has crept among pebbles. Reed shoots pierce the muddy water. Reflections of the sky in drifting whirls of water. Old junipers shake hands with the clouds. Red curtains of eglantine shine in the sad moonlight. Scented thorn grasses under cloud cliffs. Ears of wheat standing over 100 miles, and thousands of empty carts idle in the marketplaces. And I, descendant of royal princes, now a servant to others, with the deepest pleasure bend down to the earth. Sort of Chinese as a pound. What time is it now? 9 o'clock. If I go on for another 20 minutes or so, is that enough? That'd be all right. And I'll put in the time to return to this one. Just read some single poems from it. All of it. Or just the last? Yes. Yes, all right. Yes. Why not straight away? Actually, I'd like to hear that one again.
Yes, I would.
Have a repeat. Repeat. It might sound quite different this time. I think it reminded me of something in here, but I don't know if I can find it. It is nice, that last one, actually, despite the accumulation, because this is what Ezra Pound should have done, instead of getting involved in politics. Gone around on a donkey, complaining to himself. Plane trees moan in the wind like a jade-cased harp. Fireflies, messengers from the embroidered city. Willow branches spin out long streamers, a quivering bamboo grove rustles, sound of small flutes. Green moss has crept among pebbles. Reed shoots pierce the muddy water. Reflections of the sky in drifting whirls of water. Old junipers shake hands with the clouds. Red curtains of eglantine shine in the sad moonlight. Scented thorn grasses under cloud cliffs. Ears of wheat standing over 100 miles. And thousands of empty carts idle in the marketplaces. And I, descendant of royal princes, now a servant to others, with the deepest pleasure, bend down to the earth.
Nicholas reading is better. It's the art of complaining and moaning about everything. It just becomes something else by being persistent in. So the whole thing is complaints. The country's gone to rack and ruin, is what he's saying all the time. He keeps, can't help mentioning all these other things at the same time. And just by describing what he sees in front of him, it becomes something else. I'll read this one after that. I'll read this poem, which is a very difficult one. The syntax of this one is quite contorted in its way. There's basically a landscape thing to do with a valley, a limestone valley at night. The limestone is white. A limestone valley at night, where you get bits of white rocks sticking up all over the place, especially if it's an unclear night. It's quite a strange place. Strange valley, anyway. The poem got called Pure Dread. Green and white valley, and the river, fast, double, manifold, always full when most empty. Bright threads on the land, spring, grass, and history, it doesn't mean a thing if you're sure to go. Nightscape cast in space, patches of white rock glowing in the fuzzy darkness, questionless, clouded eyes turning aside. Why not, when we get what we are in the end anyway, always end up with what we are bound to? Dupal creature, quick river, every summer vanishing into the earth to secret courses and underground lakes, empty bed blazed up the valley centre, pebbles hot to the hand, carry them up to the summit caves, the ox head wake. Now constant rush and throb of water against stone, arch of sound, sides of night forming, our eyelids are stapled to the earth, we are guardless and empty without you, plodding simply back to an unnoticed room, eyelids stapled to the earth. Here and there, it'll be a bit confusing because there's a sequence here. They do refer to each other quite a lot. I'll read the last few poems of the whole thing. I think that would be enough. Then I don't have to dash off. We can sort of lie around for a bit after that or something. Yes, I'll read that one, which I consider one of the main items of the show in this book, and the follow-up. Yes, missing out the last three, missing out the code. I can't say anything about this beforehand, it's just a poem. Towards the end of this book. It is in a sequence, it does pick up on things immediately preceding it, but I think it might stand itself in. Deeper into stone than any technology can reach is the stone in the heart. Humanity partitioned from itself by gut senses of uncertain belonging, hinged on fear. Stone in the heart, on which a small bird, finch perches, tearing up the throat, poems and orders. Deep clarity of pure dread, thin light cast off the crystal arc at dawn, floating in the streets as the striped men arrive and knock on the door, whole quarters of the town change hands, forced separations of families, lovers defeated, alone, chipped and scratched songs of sleepless nights pulsing in the vein like trapped birds, whole lives donated to the structure, the facility. So in our mannered fatigue we stifle the fleshly sparrow with relish, and a stone hand squeezes the heart, year after year, pitiless pursuit of reinforced advantage, year after year, drawing the human total down into cavities of earth, dream, purposeless toil, concealed disappointment, dust of millions, grey sludge of bone powder run into the fields where it settles and weighs into the ground, expressing pockets of deceptive honey, glassy edges, flowers blurred in ice, bright winged creatures that flash past us in the tunnel, scoring the walls, a smell of burning on the edge of the city. Oh, someone's bright idea. Deaths of millions, and for what? Mere byproduct of an accelerated industrialization policy concerning nobody. Vast, unwritable acts of mass brutality, always intended by the era of substitution to do good, to bring relief. But if pain were an augmentation of reality, throw our guilt on the heap of clay stars and burnish love into the day. That poem is itself, in itself, a section of the work. I'll read the next following section of the work. And there, at this very spot arrived at, under our noses, as Williams and Orwell said, resides the difficulty. Unstructured and unstructuring particular that doesn't want to be translated anywhere, and begins the answer about wrong and guilt. That we call anything in our silence, nothing in our error. There are midges in the air tonight. It's very close. And all the intermediary separations of the distracting world devolve on this point of attention, unsevered gate that reasserts itself into script, casually through our bodies against all the pre-human facilities of a controlled situation. The midges prance in the clearing by the stream, in the sunbeam, held there by the entire universe. And I am not reminded of anything except the rotten old universe again. Naturally, it is adored from near or far. Struck at a pitch of valid energy, the range is immaterial. And the saint on his tiny island in the bay, like a doctor in his surgery, islanded off from the unhealing world and blasted out of self-regard by pressure of work. Love like this meets constantly the resistance of matter directly, as a gardener where every shrub is won from nothing into the ancestral shield and the stones rise to the hand. Reading the major items in the last section of the book and omitting the link passages between them, which don't go too well out of context, which is a bit hard because these are pretty intensive poems, these bigger ones, aren't you? The city's surface and perimeter swollen with lights, command of feeling as extended and productive, biological need, 5 police cars and an ambulance, the slightest immediate kindly act and a very gaucheness to say it. The catalogues of favour slowly accumulate in right acts of any scale, etymologies and histories of musical instruments, whether in rage or cheer, we burn through the night of thought until the flags descend on us. All the work is directed to this grace whereby in a moment's turn, as in a year's bulletin, we are rehumoured and cast resentment adrift like a fishing line in the earth's blackness behind our home. Oh, lightly, as if not bothered to justify being this forward transaction between soil and sky that sharpens its claws on the city walls and laughs at the tortuous blinds of earth, knows them to a T, and adores the green patina. Then, as the candle burns lower, the spoils of chaos are set in a wicker basket and brought to market, bearing his fatherly self for smelting, and courage is care, care is purpose, the weight of earth falls off. One of the things that happens in this book is that the poems are all in paragraphs, and the extent to which a page contains one poem, say, in three paragraphs, all three poems, becomes increasingly open to question as the book proceeds, in fact. Some of them towards the end are clearly collections of poems held on one page, held together in various ways. Another one. Flesh withstands and stands with to the world's end. Do you suppose you have any enduring structure, anything worth offering and keeping, save the enduring imagination bearing on particulars as loving care? Your life is an empty waste. The royal garden fell ages ago. This is what I was reminded of, reading the Chinese poems. The royal garden fell ages ago. Stone rings sunk into the ground, leaf debris and moss carpets over the paving flags. It is the world departing, folding in on itself. The trees spread at ease and collapse. Of 12 birches, 7 remain, and a dove bone, thin as wire, leans under the turf. No spirit, no presence, no memory. Anything seems to be saying nothing. And all this material, stone, fibre, with no one to hold it, rots, swirls, and tumbles into hell. But flesh is bound to the meeting place of earth and space by the point of efflorescence between the eyes, and tries death's employ. That's almost the end of the book, actually. So I will read a little bit. One more substantial poem. If I can find one. Several echoes from the first poem have cropped up. I noticed them myself as I was reading, both in this book and outside it. Constant echoes of this poem called Material Soul. So I don't think I could do better than read that again, actually. Material Soul. Given to death and life, no choice. Fallen into these terms, born as the tide bears the wave to its strike, cut to bedrock, crest, charge the shore. Given to this, life carving itself out of its knowledge, and the earth is like a cup to which the lip fits, and the sense's final construct moves relentlessly through substance to the houses of light, mutual, devotion, joined to death. Danger specifies its fear, the message forms its own axis or nerve, and just behind the point of contact, perception opens onto a cleared space, a settlement holding people of all ages together. The whole of life is this shift back, this rearing and arrival, which leaves a mark, a birth documentation or yell echoing down the unlivable corridors and arcades of transitional time. Flesh scores lines in the calcium slag of earth, and the spirit wakes, the needle enters the groove, polar tension shakes the circuit, which responds, gapes, tremors, issues forth into the acts of day for good. Peace is nothing without this resistance, engaging distance beyond any possible repair to the end, the inhabited city. And this is what we see and live. All round us, the world arrives at its end. Well, I wish it, and plunge into the stone. You never see me again. Yeah. Yes, well, this is a universe too, so I thought I'd read the heaviest things of this. Heavy ones too. It's called Tracks and Mineshafts. It was meant to be Tracks and Mineshafts Volume 1. But probably should have awkward this book. He didn't want to call it that because he wasn't sure he was going to publish Volume 2. In fact, Volume 2 doesn't exist yet. He doesn't like publishing a book which he just considers just like, sounds like half a book. So we got rid of the one. So the second one will have to be called something different. And we call the second one Purposes and Pitfalls. It is meant to be the first of a series like that. Hmm. But well, I don't know if it actually will be.
Gross test. What sort of period was it written over? I mean, is that a matter of months?
This new book?
Yeah.
Oh, years.
Years, yeah.
Years and years and years. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I'm a great reviser, you see. Some of those poems have existed for about 10 years in different formats. Some of them I even had the foolishness to publish some of them in magazines at an early stage in the proceedings. You know, can be chased by avid researchers. Obscure little mini graph periodicals would be totally different from what they end up as. That's how I work. I get something down on paper as quickly as possible, which is pretty foolish. And work at it, and work at it, and work at it, word by word, and line by line, which is why they end up sort of dense in the end, because each word has been sort of weighed like that. So there's also a tendency to eliminate that aspect of things as well.
I love that notion of starting off with combination colours when you use the
words. Something like that. Yes, the beginnings must have been, and I don't know what the actual influences were. It was through being at a university where they mainly taught people like Goldsmith, and at the same time you were reading William Carlos Williams and things like that. Yes. So a sort of clash of notion of what a poem ought to be was present in the text. Mm. But in rewriting it, I took the influence of people like Frank O'Hara, which is what I think I ought to have been doing in 1964. And made them a bit more like that.